Hi, friends, and welcome back. Here at Vox, we value diverse voices, and we want to acknowledge that this month, even prior to the staff transitions that have come up, we had a few more guest speakers on the schedule than usual, and they have been a welcome encouragement to us in this time. And during this transition period, our navigation team is actively discerning what's next for our community. And Waylon will offer a detailed update when he speaks next week. So stay tuned for that. And if you have questions for our pastoral staff or our nav team, you can direct those to navigation@voxvineyard.com. And so for today, we have such a treat for you. We've asked our friend and theologian, Father James Allison, to share a word of encouragement for us. James lives in Spain, and so you'll see his recorded message for us is at night, so it feels realistic with the time difference. And I want to share that I've learned so much from James and from his life and theology and writings. And if I had to say one thing about James, it would be that he is someone who I have seen just living the gospel through his grace and his courage and forgiveness. And we're privileged to have his voice in our community and have him open the scriptures with us this morning. So here's James Allison.
Welcome, my sisters and brothers of Vox Vanier in Austin. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you again. And I'm so grateful to Gideon, who invited me in the first place, to Waylon, and to Claudia for having organized and set this up so that I can talk to you today. I just hope that not too long goes by before I can talk to you presentially once again. In any case, here we are on the 29th Sunday of Ordinary Time. That's following the Catholic lectionary. And those are the texts I'm going to preach on. Those texts were set way in advance, long before we knew anything about your election. And yet, each one of the principal texts touches on something which is well known in your political life. The first is the Cyrus text, where God appoints Cyrus, who does not even know him, a completely pagan emperor, to set the Judean exiles free, to enable them to go back to Jerusalem to refound the people of Israel. And of course, as you know, some of your compatriots have used the Cyrus text as a justification for their support of a completely pagan president on the grounds that he can be relied upon to, quote-unquote, set religious people free from the terrible shackles of socialism or whatever it is that they've dreamed up as being their concern. Of course, the text doesn't have much to do with that, but we'll get to that in time. And the second text is the Gospel text, where Jesus gives the answer, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God." And some in your country are inclined to see that as being Jesus' implicit backing for the separation of church and state. I suspect it was not much on his mind at the time. We'll see how maybe what he was teaching does tend somewhere in that direction, though not in a very legalistic way. But anyhow, so instead of those things, let's actually look at the text of the Gospel. And this is rather a fun text, because it's, if not the only, certainly the major text in the Gospel where Jesus actually teaches by mime, not only by word, but by miming something. And as you'll see, it's something which is difficult to pick up just from reading the text. But once you see what he's doing, it suddenly makes an awful lot more sense of why they ask him a question, why he asks for a coin, and why he then gives the answer he does. So let's look at this text first. Where are we? Well, Jesus has just finished teaching the scribes and the chief priests in the temple. He's just put them on the spot with his parable of the wedding banquet, at the end of which, if you remember, the king comes in, sees the assembled guests, all prepared for the wedding banquet, good and bad alike, and notices someone who's not wearing a wedding garment. And he asks the person why he's not wearing a wedding garment, and the person is speechless. Jesus' teaching there was about how those who are invited have to make up their minds whether they're invited into a holy war, in which case vengeance is the rule of the game, or a wedding banquet, in which case rejoicing and forgiving and receiving what the king is offering at his son's wedding is what it's all about. But this figure is scandalized, is stuck, is unable to answer. And Jesus suggests that means that person's going to stay that way. It's going to be stuck. That stuckness is just where they are. So he's just left the chief priests and the scribes unable to answer a question. They haven't wanted to say whether John the Baptist came from God or was a charlatan, because they're frightened. If they say one thing, then why didn't they obey him? If they say another, then the people will bully them, because the people admire John the Baptist. So they stay frightened. They're silent. Now, they're aware of what Jesus has taught. And the Pharisees, who were present as well, even though they weren't particularly bothered by the temple, they can see that Jesus has set a very fine trap. Or rather, he's caught them in something where they're going to have to make up their minds. And so they try to do something similar. They go out. Rather than coming themselves, which would be too obvious, they play a rather clever game. They send their disciples, the rabbinical students, because rabbinical students can ask a clever question in a formal way and expect a teacher to give a proper answer. And if it comes to rabbinical students, it doesn't look like a trap. It looks like the kind of thing that bright kids would get up to. So that's what they do. And it's interesting that it's also some Herodians who accompany them for this particular session. The reason why Matthew brings out these two groups, given what we're about to discuss, is quite important, because both these groups were not particularly concerned about the Romans. The Herodians were the followers of the local tetrarchs, the puppet kings of Palestine at the time, those who were appointed by the Romans. So they were really very grateful to the Romans. The Romans kept them in power and actually had turned the place into a pretty prosperous province with building works. They had got on a great deal better with the Romans than they had with several of their previous colonial overlords. And the Pharisees, likewise, not particularly bothered about the Romans. You know, you have to get used to whoever is the imperial power in functions at the moment, but you're not particularly concerned about them. They were not zealots. The zealots were the people who were definitely, absolutely against, for religious reasons, the empire wanted to fight against it. But this was not the majority view. So these, if you like, are Rome-friendly people who are coming to test Jesus. And they probably want him to answer no to the question that they're about to ask him. Because if he says no and gives an answer against Rome, then of course they can denounce him. They can delate him to the Romans. And if he says yes, then they can use that to make him seem unpopular. So that's part of what their game is. Let's see how it works. They come along and they say, "Teacher, we know that you are sincere and teach the way of God in accordance with truth and show deference to no one, for you do not regard people with partiality." Now, the phrase "do not regard people with partiality," that's a slight, it's a good translation, but it misses the point slightly for something which is important in our story, because the Greek is "you do not look upon the face of men." You look upon the face, which is the same word as the person of men. You're no respecter of persons, but it means you're no respecter of faces. It's going to be important, because looking at faces is going to be an important part of our story. So they come to him, they flatter him, they show that they understand that he's perfectly able to speak against the Romans if he wants to, that he's perfectly able to speak against the temple authorities if he wants to. In other words, they're trying to flatter him so as to ambush him. But they then ask what is in fact a perfectly correct formal rabbinical question, the kind of thing students with a doubt about what is in Torah could perfectly reasonably ask a recognized rabbinical authority. It's a perfectly straightforward formula for asking it, and they ask it. "Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Now, let's be clear what they're not asking. They're not asking, is it lawful to pay taxes? It was, of course, lawful to pay taxes, and they did that the whole time. They paid taxes to the local authorities, to the tetrarchs, all of whom were Roman puppets, so indirectly they were paying taxes, they were paying Roman taxes. That was not a problem. The Torah covered all those questions. It was not in doubt. There was no need to seek a rabbinical opinion on whether or not they could pay taxes. That was already legislated for, if you like. The question they're asking is a somewhat different one, something that the Torah doesn't cover at all. The Torah doesn't cover the question of, should you pay taxes to foreign emperors? This is not part of the jurisdiction of the Torah. But it's a reasonable question. And it might be a reasonable question in this sense, in that there might have been scrupulous people, given that the, unlike the local taxes, which were paid in coinage which didn't have faces on them, the denarius, the silver denarius that was used to pay the direct Roman tax to Rome, to the Caesar, had an image on it, a silver image of the face of Caesar, and therefore might be thought to be against the commandment which says thou shalt have no graven images. In other words, people might be scrupulous, thinking, oh, I can't touch that. I can't attribute anything of value to it, because then I'm honoring an idol. So this was not a question answered by Torah, and there were grounds for scrupulosity about people who had very strict views about not handling anything that had an image on it. In other words, it was a reasonable rabbinical question, and it was asked in the proper way. And it's not unreasonable to expect a rabbinical answer to it, even if their intention was to try and put Jesus in a tough spot with relation to the various publics that he might then have to answer to. So Jesus, aware of their malice, says, why are you putting me to the test, you hypocrites? That's probably a reference to Matthew 4, the devil tempting Jesus, and this would be the temptation of having been given all the power of the world. So, if you like, this is the local instantiation of that, the temptation from the wilderness. And then he performs the mime. Now, to understand the mime, I'm going to have to introduce you to a text which is not at all obvious, which I didn't know about until a very great exegete, actually, whom I knew and with whom I was friendly, and who died a few years back in his 90s, a man called Duncan Durrett. It was he who found this 40 years ago or more, and it's a brilliant discovery. He discovered the text that Jesus was miming. And it's a text from the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm going to ask Claudia and Waylin to make it available for you so that you can read it for yourselves. Because what Jesus does is he takes this test and he enacts it in their midst. Let's have a look at this text before we see the enactment. For those of you who have Bibles, this is Ecclesiastes 7:29-8:2. And please notice, the Hebrew, the original Hebrew text has been corrupted. No one quite knows exactly how it began. We have various ancient witnesses to it, all of which Durrett looks at. So I'm giving you a translation that's an amalgamated translation. But this is what it says. See, this alone I found, that God made human beings straightforward, but they have devised many schemes. Okay, well that firstly immediately places the remarks of the rabbinical students, of the Pharisees' disciples, because they are talking about him as being a straightforward human who follows the way of God, but they have devised many schemes. In other words, this quote is very exactly characterizing what they have just done. And then the text says, who is like the wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? In other words, the disciples are coming and saying to him, you're a wise man, you're a rabbi, we all know that you follow the way of God. Let's ask you this interpretation. on the next line, wisdom makes one's face shine, and the hardness of one's countenance is changed. So here are two faces, the face shining with wisdom, and the hardened face, which is going to be changed. And of course, what we'll have in a second is a wise man pointing to a hardened face, a face on a coin, in fact. And it's wisdom that will come forth from the showing of this face, of the hardened face. So, before I get to the punchline, Jesus said to them, "Why are you putting me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax." In other words, he asked them to produce a stage prop. Reasonable enough that he didn't have one himself. It was quite a valuable coin. So he asked them to produce it. So they brought him a denarius. The denarius, this was the silver coin proper for imperial business, proper for paying the census, the tax direct to Caesar. And it had stamped on it, rather finely, a face of Caesar. Remember that some of the Caesars were thought to be gods, and actually it said so on the coin, Augustus, Divus Augustus, divine Augustus, for instance, one of the emperors. So it was literally looking at an idol. So they bring him the coin, the silver coin with a face on it. And then he says to them, "Whose face is this? And whose title?" The face and the command. The person who gave the coin value. And they answered, "Caesar's." Pretty obvious. Then he said to them, "Give therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Of course, that's the final conclusion. What he had been acting out was the next verse in Ecclesiastes, because the next verse after the hardness of countenance is changed is, in our translation, "Keep the king's command because of your oath to God." But the "keep king's command," that's a modern translation. If you want a very literal translation, it says, "Mark the king's mouth because of your oath to God." So what he's been doing? In the first instance, he's caused them to produce the face of a man. They who'd said, "You don't look on the face of men." He's caused them to produce the face of man. He has looked at it. He's looked at the face of man, and he's asked them to look at the face of a man. And then, he has marked the king's mouth because of your oath to God. He's pointed out the mouth of the king, which is the command of the king. Caesar's command is that the money should be sent to him. The money is stamped with his command, with his title. So Jesus has gazed at the mouth of the face, exactly acting out the commandment. But then he said, "Of course, yes, you can pay because of your oath to God. Because you are obedient to God, you'll do everything that God wants. And if something is not prohibited, you can do it. There's absolutely nothing against it. Be obedient to the king. That's the proper thing to do." Now, the answer is much denser than we get, because we're inclined to assume that there's a rivalry going on between God and the king. There are some things that are proper to God, and there are some things that are proper to Caesar. That's not what's going on at all. He's saying something much richer, which actually gets brought out well in the Cyrus passage. Your oath to God, your obedience to God, covers absolutely everything, because God is infinitely superior and greater, quite without rivalry to anything to do with Caesar. Therefore, because God is not in rivalry with Caesar and able to make use of such petty, pettifogging, self-divinizing tyrants, then of course you just obey them. Anything that is not against the law of God, you obey them. You just carry on. But the really important thing is that out of your obedience to God that you do that. In other words, he's giving them a rabbinical answer. He's saying, yes, you may pay tax to Caesar, and the authority for it is in this text here. But the real authority, if you like, is that God is so much greater than any mere Caesar and his silly idolatrous coins that, carry on. God is not in rivalry with anything that is. God is not in rivalry with Caesar. And any of you who are living in obedience to God do not need to be in rivalry with Caesar in any way at all. So, they've received their answer. They've received an answer which says yes to the paying of the taxes. It's a formal rabbinical answer. They were surprised by it. They were certainly amazed by the enactment of the looking of the face and of the marking the mouth of the king, the mime which he had before them. But also because he had brought out something about the complete, unrivaled, boundless hugeness of God and God's power. Because that's what this is about. It's also what we get in the Cyrus passage. Just quote from you again, because it's actually very beautiful. For the sake of my servant Jacob and Israel, my chosen, I call you by your name. I surname you, though you do not know me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. I am unrivaled. That's what that means. I am unrivaled. Beside me, there is no God. I am with you, though you do not know me. So that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is no one besides me. I am the Lord, and apart from me, all is nothing. He's bringing out the utter hugeness of the power of God and how everything else is subordinate to that. Curiously, this actually has had a genuine effect on how we in the West, in the Christian world, have developed our understanding of the relationship between royal power and divine power. Because one of the key things that we have learnt is that the royal law does not come from God. There's a strict separation. Human law is just that, human law. And furthermore, the divine law was enormously simplified for us, becoming a matter of imitating Jesus in giving ourselves up in love for others. That's the commandment of the king. That's the commandment which we have to follow under all circumstances. And this is one of the extraordinary fruits of that. It means that over the centuries, we have come to dissociate law from God. This is the great, great rupture, one of the great ruptures that Christianity produces. The word divine law means Jesus' words. Jesus' words are almost invariably non-directive. They push you in certain directions, they nudge you, they try to encourage you to find yourself in certain places so that you learn how to give yourself. But it's not a law in the constitutional or the legal sense. God doesn't do that. God brings us into being. The law we have learned is the law of coming to be who we are supposed to be to the very best of our abilities. And any human law that gets in the way of that, we're free to change. It's up to us. The human law is not a direct reflection of the divine law. The human law, mostly, is what we manage at the time. The divine lawgiver is the one who is constantly bringing us into being, enable us to work through the way we bind ourselves and each other's down, so that we may come to obey and live with and enjoy and rejoice in God. In the name of the Father, of the Son, of the Holy Spirit.